WDRBY, Roland Derby Radio, is proud to present Q-Tips with Electrocution, legendary player for the Carolina Roller Girls. Send your questions in right now to electrocution at carolinarollergirls.com. That's ELEKTRAQTION at carolinarollergirls.com. And now, get ready for Electrocution, only on WDRBY, Roller Derby Radio.
Hello and welcome to another Wednesday night. You're on live with Q's Tips. I'm Electrocution from the Carolina Roller Girls, and you can reach me at electrocution at carolinarollergirls.com, or you can find me on Facebook under Renee Q McHugh because Facebook stole my name. Tonight's guest is our coach, and I love him as a coach, and I think he's amazing. So I'm just building you up here. Is that cool? Anyway, he's our coach, Uncle Paul. And say hi, Uncle Paul.
Hello. Glad to be back.
Yeah, so it's been a really hectic couple of months for us, correct? I mean, we got in, Carolina got into D2s, so we're going to Wichita in less than a month, right?
Yep, very exciting.
Yeah, and we got in by the luck of the draw, basically. We were 62, and two teams couldn't make it. So we're in, and the first game we get to play all the way in Kansas is Blue Ridge.
It's like that movie, The Butterfly Effect,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Where you keep going back in time to try to change the outcome of events, and keeps happening.
Well, every time we go somewhere. So 2 years ago at Beach Brawl, we had to play them, and then we were like, "Can we not do this?" You know. And then we both end up going to Kalamazoo for the Roll Kill or whatever it was called afterwards, and they wanted us to play there, and we're like, can we not do this? Both of us were like, can we not? I mean, we live 4 hours away. And then we went to ECDX, and they had us scheduled to play them there. And we were like, can we not?
Yeah.
And then finally, we get to D2s, and they're like, yeah, this is happening. We can't negotiate out of this one. So I think it's been ordained by the Derby gods that we're just going to have to play them in some sort of tournament. Which, I mean, I'm happy to because I really like Blue Ridge and they're fun people, but it's still kind of like, ugh, we got to play a North Carolina team.
Great. Yeah, it would have been nice if we were in different brackets or something.
Or something, but, yeah. You know, but I'll take it because what it is what it is, right?
Yeah.
All right, so we have a lot of questions, and I know that you brought the brackets for D2s. Do you want to discuss what your choices are, or maybe, you know, talk a little bit about the teams? Because you see there's a lot of notes up there on your brackets. Do you want to talk about this D2s, or are you more comfortable talking about the other one?
Either one.
Okay.
I mean, I think the bracket we're in is a little bit harder for me to kind of say with any definity what's likely.
Okay, so why don't we talk about
the other
one?
Like I could do that anyway.
Right, let's talk about the Michigan D2s.
Okay, all right. So I think, I mean, in a nutshell, Charm is probably the strongest team that's
right
on there. And they right there at the end, they kept dropping in, dropping out, moving back into D1s. And then that great Salt Skate where Arizona popped up kind of knocked them back.
Yeah.
So
it sucks for Charm, but, you know, Detroit was in their shoes, what, 2 years ago? And Detroit came in and just dominated D2s, and they were right back into D1s right after that. So, you know, maybe this is good for Charm in the long run.
Sac City is ranked number 2 in that bracket.
Mm-hmm.
They might be overranked
for
that,
okay.
I think. So I think Charlottesville will probably beat Grand Raggedy.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and I even think Charlottesville could beat Sac City and maybe even beat Wasatch to make it into the final against Charm.
Oh,
so
they're a strong team. They really are. They're a very disciplined, strong team. They had a really good showing at D1s last year, correct?
Yep.
So, you know, being in D2s, it might be a step down, but, you know, everybody's competition is going higher and higher. You know, the levels are starting to rise higher and higher, so.
What could be interesting is could see a rematch between Grand Raggedy and Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Calgary will probably beat Cincinnati
mm-hmm.
in their first game.
Mm-hmm.
Cincinnati will probably beat Grand Raggedy, though, if they play them again. They played them in Brouhaha.
Yes.
And they had their jammers had a lot of trouble, mainly with cuts.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we played them, a couple weeks ago?
Yes.
And you could tell they've really been working with their jammers to be careful along the lines, because they take the lines a lot.
Mm-hmm.
That was a problem with their jammers at Battle of the All-Stars and then and also at Brouhaha, but it looks like they've really been working on that, because you could tell they were being very careful where they were placing their their toe stops and their feet when they were going along the line. So I think Cincinnati could probably win that. I think Tri-City will do well. Mm-hmm. I think I've got them finishing fifth in that.
Nice.
Even though they're starting out in the ninth position. So.
And so for our bracket, who do you have finishing in the top?
I haven't completed that one because I'm like, I don't know if Jet City is really going to be able to carry that. You know, we played Jet City. That was our first game this year.
Right.
They're good. They're a physical team. So I think whoever wins the Boulder County outfit, I think Boulder County is still going to be a stronger team there. Yeah, they beat Chicago. I think it was also at the Great Salt Skate a little while ago. I think the physicality of Jet City is going to give Boulder County trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I think Jet City's weakness is their jammers.
Yeah.
They're okay, but they struggle sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So that will determine how well they do against the winner of the Brandywine Kansas City game.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that game is hard for me to pick because I haven't watched either one of those teams really this year. I don't know that there's been much to watch for them.
Right, and if you don't know that, Uncle Paul is a real advocate of watching footage of other teams, you know, seeing what they do. And he'll scout out all this footage for us, and he'll give us this footage to watch, and it's amazing because it's like, wow, I don't have to go looking for it. Uncle Paul already did. Yeah. So I think that's great.
So against either Brandywine or Jets or Kansas City, I think, you know, Kansas City lost some people, and Brandywine's added some people going into playoffs last year.
Right.
And I think they finished fifth. And
they added Lurs Lemon last year too, didn't they?
So they added something to their offense. They're also a physical team,
Brandywine.
Yep. A lot of their skaters are on Team PA.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be a good game, Jet City and Brandywine.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, even if Jet City makes it past them, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of good teams. I think this bracket, if any one team steps up, Tucson would be interesting because I really don't know much about Tucson.
Right.
I looked at some of the games they played. They were in the 2014 playoffs. I don't know on Tucson. I mean, they could be a dark horse that kind of surprises everyone. I don't think so, but you know, Blue Ridge could go far.
Yeah.
Blue Ridge could go all the way if they get past us and get past Houston. I think they could play Houston hard.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, they played Nashville last year. I went to see that game, and you know, they had a very slow start where they didn't score for like the first 10 minutes, but then they played pretty tough, and they had a lot of foul outs. Other jammers were fouling out really early in the second half. So, you know, Nashville lost Sugar, I think. I don't think she's playing with them.
Sugar is not there right now.
Yeah, they lost Dagger, I think, was one of their best jammers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Nashville is the same team, so a rematch of that Blue Ridge could probably take. And so Blue Ridge could go far, you know, if they get past us.
Yeah. If they get past us. If Blue Ridge, we're coming for you.
Yeah.
So for the other brackets, what do you have? Anything shocking on the other brackets?
You know, I don't know anything shocking. I mean, that's D1s. There's so much disparity between the rankings. It's kind of easier to pick. But some interesting rematches could be Denver and Jacksonville. Denver beat Jacksonville earlier in the year,
right.
I think. Though Jacksonville would win in a rematch on that. It'd be interesting to see what Ann Arbor does. So they've got Columbia in that first game.
I think that's going to be a good game.
Yeah, Ann Arbor's got a really strong defense. They're weaker in their jamming. Columbia's stronger in their jamming, and they're very physical. So that'll be a very physical game, I think.
I was very tired after playing Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, ugh, this is a lot of work. They're not as physical as Columbia, but they're relentless. You know, they just don't stop. So...
In the Vancouver bracket, you could probably likely see a rematch between Rat City and Angel City.
Ooh, that'd be
so
nice.
That would be, they played earlier this year, and I think Rat City was the winner.
Yep, Rat City took that one, I believe.
see a rematch between Minnesota and arch rival, most likely.
Oh,
so those that's a lot of one. These brackets, yeah. The 2-3s, yeah. If they, you know, they should advance, and there are going to be rematches of games where the 3s beat the 2s in most of these this year. So that would be, or at least it came down to the very end in a lot of these games.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Boston, I think, has been improving. They look strong this year at ECDX.
Mm-hmm.
They could make it interesting against Bay Area. I don't think anyone's really going to challenge London in that bracket.
No.
But, you know, if it could be interesting between Montreal and Bay Area, because Montreal's pretty solid.
Mm-hmm.
A Dallas-Boston matchup for 5 in that one.
That would be really
tough.
Good. Yeah. So you're going to buy your package of games to watch?
Yeah, I will, even though I'll actually be at probably of two of them. Yeah. Probably because Columbia's close enough, we can drive down there.
I probably won't go but a day to Columbia. I probably wouldn't go for more than a day. There's a point where I'm like, I'm over-derbied. It's hard to sit there when you're not playing.
Not
it's
me.
Like, I know.
I'll sit there.
Yep. But at least you'll have, you know, access to the
watch.
Games. You love to watch. That doesn't sound creepy at all, Uncle Paul. All right. So we have a lot of questions tonight. And if you have any questions, hit me up on Facebook or, you know, email. But the first one comes from Betty D. Bombshell, which is a pretty good name. I like that. And she said, what's the most overlooked mistake every derby player makes and how to correct it?
Not washing your gear. No, I'm just kidding. Not listening to your coach.
No, that's another one.
probably the stance.
Okay.
I say probably derby. I mean, you can look at D3 teams all the way up to the high-level D1 teams, and where they don't perform well is when they stand up out of their stance,
mm-hmm.
or they don't focus on keeping their proper stance when they're going either to make a move as a jammer or when they're trying to block someone as a blocker. Where they run into trouble is they come up out of their derby stance, they lose their core strength,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Smarty Pants talks about all the time, don't tighten your lady parts, and and you have no lady parts to make the next move.
Right.
You know, and that's probably the biggest, if I had to pick one thing across all derby skaters, that would be it, is not keeping your stance.
It's hard. You get fatigued or you get knocked out of position and you want, I think a lot of people, especially with the way the game is going with the, you know, you have a brace, you know, and they're skating backwards. People want to be able to see, so they stand up more. You know, I call it prairie dogging. You know, you want to be able to look around. Like, it's like when you go to an office and everybody's in a cube and you're like, there's snacks in the break room, and people, you know, look up. I call that prairie dogging. So it's the same thing that happens on the track. You know, and I do find myself doing it. Like, when I'm really don't know what's going on, I'll stand up more. And I think that's when, you know, you get clocked funny or you can't move the way you want to move or whatever. And it really sucks, but it's also, you know, it's human nature to want to walk upright. You know, that's, we've been training ourselves to do that for how long now? And when you put skates on, you really can't do it the way you want to do it.
I think working on basics, just basic skating skills,
mm-hmm.
you know, if some of the lower level teams, it stands out a lot more. If you have a girl who's very good on her skates, maybe
mm-hmm.
because she was an ice skater or figure skater or something like that.
Or hockey. Mm-hmm.
She may not be the best at, like, say, playing derby or executing derby strategy or tactics on the track, but she just stands out
mm-hmm.
out there because she can move and do whatever she wants to do, where everyone else can't stop, they can't change direction,
mm-hmm.
you know, they continue to roll and roll and roll. And I think once people, they kind of get their derby license or something, and we call it getting our salesman's license and selling cars. So once you get your sale, you can't tell anyone anything. It's no, I know how to do that.
Right.
You know, it's, why would I waste time doing T-stops? I know how to do those or whatever. Working on plow stops? Come on, you know. I think going back and continuing to work on those basics to become the best skater you can be is
mm-hmm.
going to help every other aspect of what you do just about in derby.
I can see it, that it's changed how I skate, because I've really worked on certain, you know, edge stops especially. You know, since toe stops became all the rage, I had to learn how to use toe stops because our league never used them. And then I think I lost a lot of my edge work, so the last couple of years I've really been concentrating on getting that edge work back and working on those stops and the being able to go lateral and doing things like that. And I can see it. You know, I see it even when we're doing warm-ups. I'm concentrating on stopping really close, and I see other people, they're like, la, la, la. I think being the biggest mistake you can make or is an overlooked mistake as a derby player is thinking that you're perfect at something when you're not. I mean, nobody.
Or you're good enough.
Good enough.
Like saying, I know that. You know.
Right.
It's like, and it's like the saying we have up on the wall about champions. You know, it's one I got from somewhere, but basically saying, you know, you don't. Champions practice until you can't get it wrong.
Right.
And most people practice until you
get it
right the first time. It's like, oh, okay, I did it one time. I can do that now. I don't need to practice anymore.
And I do see that. I see this. It becomes like a carelessness when you think, oh, it doesn't matter. Well, it matters. Every moment out there basically matters. And when I find myself losing that focus, I try to like slap myself out of it because it's easy to be like, well, that didn't matter. Well, it does. All of it does. Because when it comes down to it, when you're put under pressure of a game or whatever, it's all going to come to how you practice. And if you practice very sloppy, and you practice in this sort of lackadaisical attitude, well, you're going to have that on the track when you're playing a game. And it sucks when a lot of people are watching you and you're playing like that. It is terrible. So that would be my two cents. All right, the next question is from Jennifer Garnett. Lineup creation strategies. It's just question mark, question mark.
Yeah. So that one can encompass a lot of things.
Right.
As a coach, you know, I started out basically kind of being taught or being shown, plan out every line, you know, every line that you want to go out. And you quickly learn by the second or third jam that's kind of hard to manage.
Yeah.
Because by the time someone goes to a penalty box, it's shot.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it used to be worse when it was a minute penalties, because that would really screw up. That could screw up three lineups. You know, you'd be like, God damn it, what do I do? Right. Yeah.
So I'm not a big fan of that as a coach, because I think part of the value that I add to the team during a game is having spent so much time studying the other team, studying our team, being able to... adjust things on the fly, so to speak, and adjust strategies on the fly. So if I have a set where I give the other bench coach a set lineup to follow, I think that's you're really you're taking away all the advantage you can provide a lot of times, other than the starting, like I can plan and come up with the perfect plan, but as soon as the game starts and that first penalty happens, it's out the window a lot of times. And you can't take advantages of mismatches sometimes as you recognize them.
I think it helps if you're aware of what your jammers are doing. You know, some jammers are on in some games and some jammers are off in some games, and it's not always the same jammers, right? So some teams work well with this jammer and some teams don't work well against this jammer. So if you see that one jammer is doing very well, I would put her out more, or maybe with a not as strong of a pack. You know, as opposed to the jammer that's struggling, you know, I would put her out with a stronger pack, because that way she's got backup, you know. And I feel like you do that, and I think a lot of coaches could learn from that.
I'm also not a big fan of random, like just saying, hey, just jam everybody and figure out who's having the best night.
No.
I'm not a fan of that, because that basically says... Sure, you always get into it, and it's like the other team's changed or they've worked on something,
right.
And so it's not what you've... studied, basically. But again, random says I can't add much value as a coach or a coaching staff and having a game plan. So strategies you can follow is you can try to match strength against strength. So if you have a very good X line that you want to try to match against their best jammer every time she goes out, you can do that, or vice versa. You want to put your best jammer out against their strongest line. You can do strong against weak. So you can try to match your best jammer against their weakest line, or your blockers. You want to try to strong against strong or weak against weak, I guess, is what I'm trying to say there. You also have to consider who works well together. So I could put an X lineup, but if they're going to be bickering at each other and they're not going to wall up because they're all
doing their own thing,
It's, it's not going to be effective. So you got to figure out who's working together, who's not chewing each other's ears off and fighting before and after the game, or just having a bad week could be part of it. A lot of it is figuring out, you can look at study either their jammers or their defense. I mean, I try to look at that and say, okay, what are their jammers likely to do? Who do we need to have? Who's the best on our team at stopping that type of jamming? Which jammers do we have that are going to be most effective against that type of defense?
Do you ever tell your teammates that kind of thing? Do You ever tell them that? Like, hey, I'm putting you out there because you're sometimes really good at stopping this person.
Yes.
Okay.
Sometimes I do.
You never say that to me. That's why I was I'm not good at stopping.
You're like the multi-tool thing.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Here we go again. Yeah, but that's what I would... I was just wondering, do you feel that helps or do you think that puts an expectation on them?
So in some cases it helps because they'll look at me and like, why are you moving me from the people I normally play with? Mm-hmm. Or why are you putting me out with so-and-so? And then I'll explain it mm-hmm. to them. A lot of times I find like in practice prep for a game, nobody remembers. They don't remember. And so in game time when it comes, you're like, why are you putting me out with this line? They just don't understand. So normally I wait till it's closer. Because sometimes I want to see, too, how many practices are they going to come to?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
How much prep are they going to do?
How much are they willing to put in?
And if they're not willing to put in the effort, then that means we got to take the next best mm-hmm. and work with them and train them. And so I don't want to tell someone and then they go, oh, okay, well, I'm the best. I don't need to come to practice. Mm-hmm. I don't need to work for this because I'm going to get playing time. So I'll kind of not really say anything until it gets really close to the game or even in my game prep sometimes
mm-hmm.
Before I'll tell them, here's what we're going to do in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Lauren Casapula says, jam start line. You got a four-wall defense. What do you want your blockers to think and to do when that whistle is about to blow? I should clarify, then what do you want the blockers to do once the whistle blows?
Yeah. So there's a lot of awareness things mm-hmm. right as you're going out. Hopefully on the bench, you've already talked about a strategy, what you're going to try to execute when you get out there, either based on who you're facing or the jammer that you have. A lot of times it's going to be the jammer that you have
mm-hmm.
or depending on how far in the game you are, what you're learning about the other team and the adjustments mm-hmm. you're trying to make, whether you want to take the front or the back or if you're going to try to play on the outside off the line or whatever it is. But I want to be aware, okay, do we have the right number of blockers out there based mm-hmm. on who may or may not be in the penalty box? Do we have our jammer out there? Does everyone have their helmet covers?
Yeah.
You know, are you in the right formation? Are you lined up where you want to be? And then look for things like, how's the other team lined up?
Mm-hmm.
Are they lined up to play O against you? Are they going to try to pick your brace right at the beginning? Are they going to try to set an inside pick? As one girl, you know, like watching some of the footage, it's very clear when someone's about to set a pick because they raise one of their heels mm-hmm. up. And you can tell, rather than being flat-footed, she's raising her heel so she can push off.
Yep.
So, you know, look for stuff like that. Look for little clues. What's about to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And how can you make a quick adjustment? Or what's going to be your plan of action? Once everything starts, probably the biggest... The thing that encompasses everything is what I told you in that boost game is make a play.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Make a play. It all kind of comes down to that. And try to be a playmaker.
Mm-hmm.
If you can execute, you know, we talked about job number one for a blocker is to stop the jammer. I learned at the ref clinic, that's not really job number one.
It's to create a pack.
It's to make a pack, right? Because that's always been our problem. It's like we keep saying, hey, job number one is stop the jammer. Nope. That's why you get all these pack destruction penalties.
Which we haven't been getting, so right. That's good.
Yeah, but we've been practicing mm-hmm. that a lot more. So job number one really is to make a pack.
That's according to the refs.
Right.
Job number one is to stop the jammer.
Job number one is to stop the jammer. Job number two is to help you play jammer. Offense, get your jammer out.
Yep.
And that does not necessarily mean being active.
Right.
It could mean, you know, like a hit it and quit it type or playing positional or what do you call passive
mm-hmm.
And just being smart about it. But there really is a lot to try to take in. That's why we talk about track awareness so much.
Yep.
Because the next level above that is paying attention to what the refs are doing.
Yep.
What kind of conversations are they doing? What are they looking at?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're really looking at my feet, maybe I got my feet placed wrong.
Oh, yeah. I always look at that. When I see the refs, you know, if you're on the line and you're on that back line and all of a sudden the refs are like, they like vulture in. That's what I call it. I'm like, uh-oh, somebody's feet aren't, you know, right. I'll make sure arm placement.
If I'm already doing the flying buttress thing on the outside and that outside pack ref is looking right at me, I'm like, okay.
Back off.
Yeah.
Yep, I know. And it is being very aware. And I think that's fine. I mean, that is part of paying attention to the rest. They're not doing anything to give anything away. They're looking. You're allowed to look, and you're allowed to look at them and go, huh, what are they seeing that I got to worry about? I mean, that's normal. Yeah. All right, next question is from Captain Lou Oblamo. Have you done a how do you know when it is time to retire section yet? Well, no, but I'm definitely retiring at the end of the year. And I can tell you why I am retiring is I've spent a long time in this sport. It's been 8 years. It'll be 8 years by the end of the year. And it's taken a lot out of my life. And there's some things I want to reclaim from my life. And I think that's the best reason, to not leave it because you hate it or you're mad at it or you're tired of it. I think it's because it's time to move on to something new. I really don't hate the sport. I'm going to miss it. It's going to be really hard for me, like especially when I come to watch or something, or if I ref, I'm going to be like, oh my God, I want to play so bad. But it's, you know, it's time for me to move on. I'm 46. There's a point where osteoporosis is going to be an issue. Now, I learned something in my last broadcast. We had the gentleman from Derby Injury Prevention Network, and he said, brain injuries don't necessarily bother the older people. And I was like, yes! So that's awesome. But
their brains are already gone.
That's right. They're probably already demented out. Okay. But the fact is that, you know, I do worry about head injuries. I worry about other, you know, I've broken bones in my derby career. I've got some nagging injuries. I'd like to take care of myself, you know, not get beaten up all the time. And also not deal with all the league stuff. League stuff can be really, it sucks the life out of some of the fun. So, you know, like, oh, you have to do your hours, or you have to go to this committee meeting, or you have to run this practice. It's a little much. So, gonna reclaim some stuff like art.
Yeah.
So I think that's the best, I mean, to look at your life, and if it brings you joy, keep doing it. If it doesn't, take a step back from it and see if you'll really miss it or not. That would be my suggestion. I mean, I know you're not looking at retirement.
No, I hope not. I mean, you know, I was, you know, as a volunteer, I mean, I don't know that I would stay in it forever, but I would stay, I mean, as long as there's a need and people still want me around.
And you're enjoying it, yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. It has to come down to, do you enjoy it or not? Nobody's getting paid. Well, very few people are getting paid, but you know, you have to enjoy it. And there's a point where I'd like to enjoy other things too. So I'd like to look at the banquet that is life as opposed to the single serving that is derby right now. All right, next question is from Andrew Davison. What are your thoughts as CRG prepares to go to D2s?
How can we freeze time and prepare for 6 months?
Yeah, right?
You know, look, I mean, the first thing was, hey, we did it. That was our goal. You know,
it was our goal.
We talked about that 2 years ago when we sat down and I had just kind of become coach, and we were like, do we want to try to get back to playoffs? And everyone was like, yes, we want to be competitive. We want to get back to playoffs. And so achieving that is great. That's a big goal. And we talked about goal setting through, because that's a big thing too. Not just in roller derby, but any sport. When you set a goal and you reach it, such as getting to playoffs, you lose that drive, you lose that energy, and you get somewhere, you actually get into the playoffs, and you get your butts handed to you because you don't have the drive and energy to prepare. You don't have the drive and energy to play well when you get there. And so it's kind of like there's no goal beyond that. So we talked about what do we want to get from this opportunity.
We discussed it as a team, which I think was really good. And we discussed, you know, our best case scenario and our worst case scenario, and where people would all be like satisfied but not exactly ecstatic about it, you know. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting discussion. And I think, you know, we'll keep that to ourselves for this. But I think it's something, if you have a long-term goal, you really do have to talk it out, because you got to get at least 14 people on the same page. And it really, that's very hard.
Yeah. We talked a lot. I especially wanted to do that because just the stress of normal derby throughout the year, a normal derby season, take that and magnify it by whatever factor you want to do as you go into a playoff situation. And so I was very concerned that, you know, people, yes, this is a volunteer sport, so it's an amateur sport. So you can't just stop everything you're doing and go all out and mm-hmm. prepare for playoffs just because you made playoffs. And so it would put a lot of stress on people, and people would start snapping at people with different who are able to give different commitment levels mm-hmm. if we say, we're going to win it all, you mm-hmm. know.
We're going, like, well, we're going to be on ESPN.
Not everyone can practice 7 days a week right. for it, or even 3 days a week right. or whatever it is. So that put a lot of intense stress on everybody, and that would really make it tough mm-hmm. to have everyone coming in as a team together if everyone's so stressed out. You know, we're the lowest seed in mm-hmm. in all of the WIFTA playoffs, mm-hmm. so there's potentially not a lot of expectation for us anyway. So right. anything we do, we win one game and we have done better than our ranking, basically. Right. So we should be going into it with, hey, we don't have the stress that all the other teams have.
It's true. So, I think having been there in 2013, that was my first real, you know, first taste of playoffs. It was interesting. I mean, people deal with stress differently when you're there. I don't think you can prepare for the stress that you feel because everyone handles it differently. Like, I would see minor explosions. You know, nothing team wrecking or game wrecking, just people melting down here and there, quietly, separately, thank God, you know, it wasn't like something that ran through the whole team, but it is stressful. You're there possibly playing four games, you know, maybe, you know, under a lot of scrutiny, you've got a lot of high level reffing going on, you're trying to show that your team's doing well, and you feel a little let down if you lose a game. I mean, but you have to look at it that there's another game, so get ready for that one. And you need that downtime, and there's not a lot of downtime because you might be playing two games in a day.
And tournament play like this is very different than rank point play mm-hmm. that most teams do at the level we're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you have to realize you just have to win, and you have to win by 1 point.
Right.
And so that you have we've had a little bit of a discussion, but we have to have discussions and understand that the sometimes the calling is going to be different. We're mm-hmm. not always going to want to call a jam when we might under a normal game situation. We might run some things differently. We might run some strategies differently, simply because all we have to do is win.
Right.
And sometimes when you have some momentum behind you, you figure out you have a mismatch out there on the track. You got to be able to take advantage of that.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen so many teams, and there was an article you shared with me
right.
that talked about that, where you sit there in frustration because they finally get their best jammer out there.
Right.
They get lead.
Actually, you know,
and they
lead.
Call it after getting a partial scoring pass. Mm-hmm. And it's like, run it. Run the jam. Get as yep. many points as you can. And in a tournament situation like this, you know, it's not natural because the entire team or the third base coach or everyone in the crowd
it's
or the jammer itself is thinking,
call it.
It's like, and no one listens to the coach, you know. So it's a little bit different style of play.
We'll get you a megaphone. It'll be okay.
Yeah.
All right. Next question is from Andrew Davison. I'm sorry, from Chrissy Davis. How to stay nourished on the go? What kind of snacks are best to travel with to tournaments like D2s when car, plane, train, travel, and hotel rooms are the norm? I think it's really important to go out if you can get, you know, we're going to be flying. I mean, I think almost all the teams flying this time. So I think we're going to be flying. Someone will rent a car. We'll get a couple cars, and we'll go out and get some snacks. I mean, you're not going to be able to get a whole meal kind of situation, but peanut butter, bread, you know, if you can get cereal, milk, stuff like that, especially breakfast stuff, because a lot of people don't like getting up and going out and getting breakfast. I personally love eating breakfast out
yeah.
when I'm on the road because it's like, I need all those calories, so I'm going to eat them. But things like that, I always get Diet Coke and put it in the fridge because I need that caffeine, and it's not always easy to get if depending on the hotel. You know, it's just something, whatever works for you is what you should eat. You know, this shouldn't be the time where you're experimenting with crazy food.
Yeah.
This should be basics. You know, a lot of people get, you know, the breakfast bars or, you know, protein bars and protein snacks, just stuff to keep you going through.
I try to make breakfast my biggest meal of the day
mm-hmm.
on tournaments because you just don't know when you're going
exactly.
to be eating again
exactly.
on some of those.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times the food options are chicken fingers, you know.
Yeah, you love those chicken fingers.
which is fine, I guess, if you have to. There's a lot of variation in the quality of those.
It's like you and magic eat chicken fingers. It's like, bleh. But yeah, I think it's important. I know we have a ton of devotees in our league that have to have their Starbucks, have to. And as you were saying, and it kind of comes down to that other question, but you were saying you know where every Starbucks is in Kalamazoo.
Yeah, we figured that out. I felt like Uber up there driving everyone.
Oh my God, and I don't care about coffee at all. So it's like, for me, it's like, you really need to have the special coffee. Yes, the answer is yes. So whatever makes them happy, I'm happy as long as my teammates are happy. So whatever they're doing to, you know, give themselves nutrients, I'm fine with it.
Well, the times we've been to PA, you know, with Battle of the All-Stars, even for ECDX, where you're in a tournament situation and you're going to be at the venue all day long. You know, it was nice. You know, Mama Switch at her house, she had fruit for us. Mm-hmm. So we were able to take some fruit, stick it in her backpack, water. I always want to have some water with me. But then I do try to make breakfast my biggest meal and eat something good. And then just look for the best food option at the venue.
I can eat anything and I'll be okay. But there are some people out there that with really sensitive stomachs that they can't eat too much or something this way. Like, I can eat Chipotle before I play. Like, I love it. And people are like, I can't do that, you know. And you just have to know what works for you. So if you've ever been on the road and you know what disagrees with you, avoid it.
I see a lot of girls, they'll bring fruit. Mm-hmm. I also see a lot of all kind. I mean, gummies, whatever.
I use a lot of Swedish fish. I like stuff like that.
Beef jerky, lots of beef jerky.
I don't eat a lot of beef jerky just because I don't know what's in it.
And anything that the hosting team has left gets devoured.
Oh, God, yeah. I'll even eat bananas during tournaments because I freaking hate bananas. And Bethro and I used to share bananas because we both hate them. But it's a really good snack for potassium and getting some sugar in you. But I hate them. It's like, I'll eat this banana just because I love my team.
But Christy's right. I mean, it is a challenge.
Especially
when you're traveling and when you're at tournaments where you're at the venue for so long, you're kind of limited a lot of cases by what's at the venue.
Right. Okay, next question is also from Christy. What's the downtime between bouts like? Is there usually a team ritual CRG likes to partake in right after big bouts or something to wind down? It depends. I mean, when we were at Kalamazoo, usually Blue Ridge was playing right after us, so we would watch their bout. You know,
get our chicken fingers and go.
Well, you would get your chicken. Yeah. The rest of us got beer. Watch that, because it was the last game. During D2s, you may play a game at 10 o'clock in the morning and then have to play one at 1. So you're probably staying at the venue, getting food, and getting ready for the next game. So it's not easy to have a ritual. You just hope everybody shows up where they need to be, when they need to be.
I'm mainly focused on making sure everything that was in the bench area gets picked up and we get all of our stuff out so the next team can come in and so we don't lose anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then making sure, just trying to communicate, everyone knows when to regroup and where.
Right.
And then let everybody do their own thing,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is that they want to do. And I'm normally focused at that time on trying to watch as many of the other teams as I can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of watching, especially when we know where, you know, what game we'll be playing next. We'll probably be in there watching the other teams play, just so we know what's going on.
And then as it gets closer to game time, it's just making sure we get everybody where they're supposed to be at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Which is hard.
And figuring out when the captains and coaches meeting is,
mm-hmm.
and warm-up times, benches, that sort of thing. So nothing too crazy as far as rituals or anything, but for my job on game days, I feel like my biggest thing I can do is stay calm, keep everybody calm, get everybody where they need to be, and communicate all the timelines for everyone.
Chrissy has a second question. Uncle Paul, what's it like being in the middle of all the team on trips away for days at a time? How do you manage to keep up with everything on the go? Coaching needs, gear, malfunctions, skater issues. Well, Uncle Paul does not deal with gear malfunctions. He's like, that's your job. And I think that's a good and healthy policy, because
I talk about that.
You tell us. You're like, clean your gear. Make sure it's working. Make sure you've got all your wheels. Make sure you're bearing, you know, make sure everything's in there the way it should be. You give us the warning. You're like, Mom, bring your warm coat. You might get cold, right? but, you know, some people listen and some people don't. And the good thing about going to something where there's a tournament, there's usually a gear shop there. And they're usually, they will help you.
Yeah.
So you're not on your own, like when you go to an away game somewhere. They'll have someone that'll be like, we can fix your skates. And that's pretty sweet. It still is your job to learn how to fix your own damn gear, though.
Yeah. It just surprises me. I mean, I get a little frustrated with it the longer I'm in derby and coaching. It's just like, how many times have we talked about this? How many times have we shown up to a venue and you can't fully participate in a warm-up
mm-hmm.
or like a pre-warm-up session because you waited to the very last possible second before changing out your bearings or putting your new wheels in
or your toe stop came out.
And then you can't find a press and then you can't find whatever. And so it's, that part is very frustrating as a coach.
Well,
because that's something you can do well in advance.
Right. And I don't think there is any excuse as a derby player not to have one of those little handheld bearing presses. You know, they're like a punch. I forget what they're called, but they're not expensive. They don't take up a lot of room in your bag. Just bring one. You know, just have it. Write your name on it. Tie it to your bag if you need to, but it doesn't take that much. Or be like someone like me. You get two sets of bearings and you put them in your spare wheels and you don't have to mess with a bearing press when you're on the road.
Yeah.
I mean, just clean your bearings. Everybody's got bearings that need to be cleaned. Sit down with your team, clean all the bearings. You know, lube them up and put them in your spare set of wheels.
I don't know. Part of it as a coach, too, I just feel like this is like you're standing in the middle of a disaster. You know, like a natural disaster. It's like you're in the middle of a hurricane or you're out in the middle of a flooded river and there's
shit flying around.
There's just nothing you can do except just be there because you can't control it. You can't stop it. It's just, it's going to happen no matter what you do. So just try not to get in its way where it attacks you. as a lot
so
of
you're
it.
Like the eye of the hurricane,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. And I end up, you know, trying to shuttle people around for food or meet people for food. Or
and that's nice, though. I mean, I think that's chill. I think you've pulled me aside when I'm about to strangle someone and said, let's go get food. Yeah. That was really smart because really, to feed me is to calm me down in general. So I'll be like, yeah, I can eat. So, next question, Christy Davis. How has derby changed your life in daily interactions with people, i.e. work, relationship, friendships, everyone, not in the derby verse?
Well, I think the number of people I'm friends with on Facebook, like, quadrupled
yes.
because of that,
yes.
because of derby.
You also got a lot of lesbian ads on your Facebook page.
No, I did not get lesbian ads.
I
no,
thought it was.
No, men.
Men, oh, yeah. Sorry.
they thought.
Homosexual ads.
Right, they were trying to pick my preference.
I see.
For me, yeah. But a lot of people, when they find out I'm a derby coach, are like, what, really? You know, most people think it's really neat. And, like, during playoffs when I'm up at the radio station, mm-hmm. now I'll have playoffs
right,
broadcasting right. and all the kids walking by will be, like, just transfixed at, mm-hmm. at the screen watching
well, now they can look at
derby.
You.
Yeah.
So have you do you find yourself thinking about people differently because you've been in derby now for a couple years?
Thinking about them differently? No.
Well, I mean, I recognize some behaviors that are, I would almost brand as specifically derby behavior, and I see it out in the real world, and I'm just like, oh, this person might have some issues.
No, not so much.
Okay.
Probably the most interesting thing is you can get around derby people and just, I'm just comfortable mm-hmm. with all the craziness, mm-hmm. really. All the things people are wearing, saying, all the hairstyles, all the yep. piercings, all the mm-hmm. tattoos, which, you know, being a metal, into metal and just, I mean, there's a lot of that in that community too, but
right.
this just anything is accepted pretty much.
You'd be sitting next to a guy with horns on his head and you'd
right.
be like, whatever.
Yeah. yeah. With his belly hanging out yeah. and wearing fluffy leg warmers or something. It's just like, no big deal. You're talking derby. And
yeah.
And most people look at that and go, something's up here. I'm going to stay away from that. But
that scares me.
But it, yeah, there's, it just feels natural. It's comfortable. It's just kind of a interesting community. But,
it is an interesting community, and it's definitely a community. I feel like Derby has changed a lot of things in my real life. One of them is I have no problem going through a crowd anywhere. Like, if there's a crowd in front of me, I'll just go through them now. And before, because I'm rather reserved when it comes to people, I don't like people being in my bubble, you know. But in Derby, you don't have a bubble, so it's taught me how to deal with that. If I'm walking through the mall and there's a bunch of slow people in front of me, I'm like, through them. I don't even think about it. I'm just like, get out of my way. I don't push anybody down or hip check them. Yeah. It's just, I go through them, where I wouldn't have before. I would have just been like, or I'd gone around them, you know. I'd tackle things more head on now with Derby. And hopefully I won't lose that, because it's actually made walking a lot easier.
It's also funny to me how many people ask me, what do you guys do with the ball in dirt? And really, I know that keeps coming up on your show, you're talking to people, but that...
My dad says that.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, what do people... And we were joking about that last night when we were playing that game with the ball. It's like, well, that's what you do with the ball in roller derby.
My dad still will ask me where the motorcycle is, because he liked Rollerball from 1968 or 71 or whatever it was. He thinks that's a great movie. And so he'll be like, I think you should have a motorcycle and a ball in there. And I'm always like, ugh. You know, he knows it just gets on my nerves. So. Love you, Dad. All right, next question. Anonymous question. Do you think it's possible for someone who loves derby and knows a lot about the sport and rules and strategy, etc., has played but is not the best player or skater, to be a decent coach?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because you're not a skater.
I'm not a skater.
And you're a very good coach. So I think you have to really know what your limitations are, though. Some people think they understand the rules and the strategy, and then they just don't. You know, it comes out. When you start coaching, you'll know what your weaknesses are, I think. It's like being a teacher. You know what your weaknesses are. You're like, oops, I'm really good at explaining things, I'm not really good at responding to questions right away. Or, I'm really good at responding to questions, but my explanations kind of suck. People are lost when I'm trying to explain something. So you have to really look at yourself and be honest. Sit down with your team and say, hey, what can I do better as a coach? But I don't think you have to be this awesome player.
No. And there are different types of coaches, obviously. Some coaches are very good at keeping things on task.
Yep.
You know, so running a very good, very well-structured practice might be what you're good at. Some of it might be you have very good insights on strategy or things that skaters want to do. Or you can watch someone skate and go, hey, you know, you're putting your toe stop down, or your toe stops might need adjusting because your toe stop seems a little high, and so you're going up too high when you go down on your toe stops or something. Those little things can help skaters a lot, because they can't see that for themselves,
right.
A lot, or they're blinded to that, the blind spot on those things.
And, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, there's coaches that can plan really good practices. There's coaches that maybe you can't demonstrate the skill the way you want. Well, that's why you have people out there that can do it. You know that there's someone in your league that can do it. So
except one-footed hockey stop.
No,
when are we going to get that person?
Well, okay, as soon as you get there.
Okay.
But the point is, you know, to be able to, you don't have to. Uncle Paul's not on skates, so he'll explain something to us, and we may have to throw someone out there as a sacrificial lamb and say, "Is this what you mean?" Because it's hard. It's a difference between saying it and doing it sometimes, and derby people need to sometimes just see it, because we're like, duh, you know, especially when we're in that mindset. And we have a coach on skates, so he can help with that, and that's Nathan.
Yep.
So, you know, there are different roles. I think the ones that don't do well as coaches are the ones that aren't aware of what their strengths and their weaknesses are. And I see a lot of newer coaches coming in and thinking they understand strategy, and they don't.
Or ones who think it's about just being in charge.
Yeah.
Being yelling, screaming, I'm in charge, I'm do this, do that.
I find it, even when they're really good skaters, some people are just not good coaches. And it's just a skill. It's a skill like anything else you do. And I think the thing that makes me angriest about coaches that don't do well is that the waste of the time. I think that's my biggest problem, is that if we're wasting time and we have a limited amount of time anyway, and the practice isn't planned out well, or, you know, they're not moving people along or at a certain time, then it's like, are you kidding me? We have 2 hours And now we just spent 40 minutes kind of just staring at each other going, well, what are we going to do now? You know, and that's very frustrating. So the first thing you probably need to do as a coach is plan your time.
One thing I would say too, you say, hey, if I really know something about Derby or really like Derby, but I don't want to be a coach, I think the danger there too is, especially what I see in games, is you wind up just watching.
Yeah.
And you're basically a spectator with really good seat,
right? Yeah, basically. You're right in the front of everything. Yep.
And so, you know, that's not what really the team needs.
Right.
Because some of it could depend on the dynamic on the team, whether you have more of a skater coach or captains who are really strong in determining who goes out and mm-hmm. win and that sort of thing. But I see a lot of coaches, they're just kind of standing there watching the game and they're missing lineups there's confusion about lineups. There's mm-hmm. people don't have the panties and all this stuff going on. It's because they're just kind of standing there watching what's going on.
Yeah, I think you have to be able to, and it's if you're going to be, and there's different coaches, right? So there's game coaches, which, you know, we vote in a game coach, and there's practice coaches, yeah. you
they
know.
They can be conditioning coaches.
Right.
We've
had jammer coaches. We've had, you know, guys come in off skates that do boxing, and they're conditioning coaches. And you don't have to be the coach at the game. I think that is a very pressured situation, and some people are really good at it and some people aren't, and you probably aren't going to know until you go into a game. You know, can you remember to put a lineup? What's the next lineup? You know, you need your people. If you want your people discussing things on the bench, you better put them in a lineup so they know who they're talking to. I mean, it really is, that's a pressured situation that I don't think everyone can step into. But running a practice, sure. You know, I would start small, run a newbie practice,
run part of a practice.
Yeah, part of a practice, or do, you know, half a practice or something. But, you know, the game one, you don't know until you get in there.
Yeah.
And you may discover that's not your thing. Or you may discover you're awesome at it. So it doesn't matter if you're the best skater or not. You know, are you an observant human being that can anticipate the needs of the team? All right, next question. As a coach, what are your thoughts on not having an inside whiteboard? I am finding it rather troublesome. With everything the coaches are doing during and in between jams, it can get a bit overwhelming. Can I get a little extra love? Can I get a little love for an extra spot on the bench for another coach, or possibly a whiteboard behind the penalty box with the number of penalties tallied per skater? Neither is too hard, and when the game is going on, the penalty type is less important than how many each skater has. What are your thoughts on this?
So when they started taking away the whiteboard, I was not happy with that.
No, I wasn't either.
Because I did rely on that some as a coach, being able to see, like they mentioned, not so much the type of penalty always, sometimes, but certainly the number of penalties.
Right.
I could do a quick glance, hopefully, and say, okay, I don't want to put her out as a jammer because she has 5 penalties.
Right, right.
She cuts a track and gets an insubordination. Now we're
screwed.
We're out of jammer. So... I didn't like that at first when we went to ECDX and they had the Ringster computers back behind the bench.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. That was the greatest thing in the world.
Right.
Because now it's no longer trying to look past all the NSOs and all the refs walking
in front of
the whiteboard.
Writing.
Anytime I wanted to know where someone stood, I just turned around and the computer was right there.
Right.
And my understanding is that's what they're supposed to have at playoffs. So
that
I really like. Because, you know, I can see it anytime I want to. It's right there. It was right there at the bench. Mm-hmm. I could take 2 steps, look at it, get all the information I need,
everything.
And turn right back around and do what I need to do on the bench or washing on the track. And I thought that was great. I would rather have that than a whiteboard. So if they're going to, you know, getting rid of the whiteboards to make it, you know, better for broadcast, I would say you need to have that, especially at tournaments.
Well, I think it wasn't just for broadcast, though. It's the idea of getting rid of the whiteboard removes one of the positions, or at least 2 of the positions, that you have to have NSOs at. And since our sport takes so many people to run a game, they're looking at cutting down those positions. Because we used to have an outside whiteboard, too, you know, certain turns that would communicate with the inside whiteboard. Well, they got rid of that, too. So I think they're looking to make it a little bit more streamlined. I personally think that every player needs to know what their penalties are.
Yeah.
I mean, regardless of whether they're posted on a whiteboard or not, you should know, I got 3, I got 2, I got 4, I can't
But
jam.
If you really want to play,
yeah.
You're not going to tell. You're not going to remind the coach. I mean, there are players that are like, "Hey, I want to block and I want to jam. And if I've got those five penalties, I may not be able to go back out and jam again."
That's not a team player.
I know, but it happens.
That's a discipline thing. That is not cool. If you are not honest about your penalties, then you shouldn't be out there. I mean, it's just like, I think it's the same thing as jammers knowing or kind of knowing how many points they have, because God knows, you know, there's. Some people hold up two fingers and the ref gives them three, or they give them one or two. I get that, but you should know your points. And I used to ask all our jammers, how many did you get? And they'd be like, like, that's something we should be, you know, holding them to. Yeah. It's a discipline. You should know your penalties. You should know who's been giving you the penalties. And you should know your points, you know, and you should know what your jam ref looks like.
Missile's really good at that. Missile,
yes, she is.
The first time we went to Battle of the All-Stars and I was there with Missile, after every jam, Missile knew who got what points on every pass and was like telling me, hey, they didn't give her a point on that pass. And I was like, you know, she's just the one that got me really watching to make sure the jam ref was awarding points.
And that's an amazing thing, and she has an amazing skill, and I think that's the kind of skill we all need to have, is that you have that kind of, that's an awareness thing, right? She's a jammer, so she was watching other jammers to make sure that they were getting their points. I'm a blocker, I watch the penalties, I watch all of them, you know, I know exactly how many penalties everybody on my bench has, regardless of a whiteboard or not. Regardless, I couldn't see the ringster thing, but I knew, because I'm like, uh-oh, she's in trouble, or uh-oh, I'm in trouble, or, you know, or she's fine, let's put her out more, you know? And so I think that's something we all need to be aware of. Just, you got to take ownership of certain things. Take ownership of your gear, take ownership of getting to places on time, take ownership of penalties, and take ownership of your points. I mean, if you want to be good. Now, if you want to suck, do what you want. But that's just my opinion. All right, so we're going to end with this last question. How did you decide, jammer or blocker? Or is it generally decided for you? I love doing both. Well, I'm glad you love doing both, because that's amazing, because I don't understand anyone that likes to jam. I think jammers do rise to the occasion, but I also think it's thrust upon them at the same time. Like, you see somebody that comes in and they can skate really well, and they, you know, they're new, their skills are good. Like you were talking about the girl that's really good on her skates because she played hockey or she was a figure skater before. She has a propensity probably for the team, especially if the team needs jammers really badly, to be jamming, you know. She doesn't necessarily have to know anything about the game the way a blocker does. And which takes a long time. I think it takes a long time to train both, but I think it takes a long time to grow blockers mentally, because they have to know so much. So I think a lot of really good skaters at first are thrust into the jammer spotlight, whether they want to be there or not.
Yeah. And some start out wanting to be one and then decide they want to switch to the other. I see more switching from jammer to blocker than I do from blocker to jammer.
I think it might be because you get beat up so much as a jammer. You're like, I can do this for this amount of time, and then I think there's a point where you're like, I can't do this anymore, like, not at the level I want to do it at, so you move to blocker. And being a blocker is nothing easy either. It's just a different kind of beating up, you know.
As a coach, I know some people would probably disagree with this, but I really do try to accommodate what the skater wants, as long as they can demonstrate a reasonable amount of ability at the level of the opponent we're going to be playing. I look for people who display the ability to learn what we're trying to teach our jammers, and don't go out there with what we talked about in the past with lizard brain, you know, where you get so, it just is nothing but adrenaline and base thinking functions that are working.
Survival. Right. You're in survival mode.
So people who can go beyond that and actually think at some level when they're out there is what I'm looking for, because that is a very key position. You get a jammer penalty is not the same as getting a blocker penalty.
Exactly right.
You get a jammer penalty and it hurts the team much more so than losing a blocker or even two, blockers. So that is a very key position. And just going out there and flailing and saying, I'm trying my best. I don't, you know, part of it, when you go into that stress mode like that, your perception narrows. You mm-hmm. don't see the opportunities that you really have to get out and get through some of those walls because you're so narrow-mindedness mm-hmm. and your higher functions are shut down. So that's what I'm looking for, is I'm looking for someone who can be as calm and as thoughtful and as purposeful about what they're trying to accomplish when they're out there.
Yeah, I just hate jamming. It's a terrible thing. I think though, and I had a coach tell me this from a long time ago. He said, I think we put you in to jam too early. We didn't give you any survival activities. He's like, you were strong, you were fast, and you know, you could get through, but we didn't give you any tools to work with, so you hated every minute of it. Like, it just put a lot of stress on you. And he goes, and I think that's why you don't like jamming now. He's like, and it sucks because I could have trained you up to be a jammer. I'm like, well, you didn't. I'll be a blocker. I'm good. There's some people that like jamming because there's a lot of glory involved in it. You know, they like that recognition. You know, photographers take great pictures of you. You get a lot of, you know, time from the announcers. A lot of people like jamming for a lot of those reasons too. I prefer not, you know, but some people like it. And I'm glad they do, because otherwise we wouldn't have this sport. All right. So you have wasted another hour listening to Q's Tips. This program is brought to you by houseofskate.net, code ELECTRA, ELEKTRA, all capital letters. It'll get you 10% off your order. And Christy Creamer and Man Candy from Kinston's Roller Derby League, Ring City Roller Girls. Ring City will be hosting their 4th annual Masquerade Brawl Invitational on October 29th at Galaxy of Sports. This year's Masquerade Brawl will be Game of Thrones themed and will feature mini bouts for rookie, intermediate, and experienced skaters, open to men and women. Check out the Ring City Roller Girls Facebook page for event details or to just give them a like. Ring City practices at Galaxy of Sports in Kinston Monday and Wednesday nights from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Contact them for open practices if you'd like to join in on the fun. Ring City Roller Girls, bringing roller derby to Eastern NC since 2006. Do you watch Game of Thrones, Uncle Paul?
I don't watch any TV.
That's true, he doesn't.
I watch derby. That's it.
He's weird. So what are you planning? One thing that you're excited about going to D2s? What's the one thing? Other than derby. Other than derby. We're going to Wichita. So what are you excited about?
I've never been to Wichita before.
I've never been to Kansas before.
I've been to Kansas before, but I've never been to Wichita. So there you go. Another pin I can put on the map if I had one of those.
If you had one of those.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening, and tune in next week. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.